The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, equipping and supporting New York's startup business community with Mac repairs and upgrades, on-site setup and support, free seminars and events, equipment rentals, sales, consultation, and more. Studio.techserve.com. And An American in Paris, the new Tony Award-winning musical that brings the magic and romance of Paris into perfect harmony with the unforgettable songs of George and Ira Gershwin, winner of more awards than any other musical of the year. Tickets at AmericanInParisBroadway.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. People in Cuba will surely remember this day, a visit by the President of the United States. Obama has landed one huge leap for regional politics and a leap away from the Cold War. Just the picture of Raul Castro and Barack Obama walking in a receiving line with an honor guard playing was transformative. Castro and Obama followed up with a joint news appearance at the Palace of the Revolution.
And I'm especially pleased that I'm joined on this trip by so many Cuban Americans. For them, and for the more than 2 million proud Cuban Americans across the United States, this is a moment filled with great emotion. Ever since we made it easier to travel between our countries, more Cuban Americans are coming home. And for many, this is a time of new hope for the future.
Heady stuff from Havana. We will also meet this hour a man who remembers every event in his life with equal vividness. Presidential visits, buying cat food, all the same in his curious brain that sees every moment of the last 15 years. Hard to know if that's an advantage, but we will talk to him and get a real feel of what it's like to be in his brain. Plus, disruptors in business that sometimes managers overreact to. But we begin with an historic 3-day presidential visit to Havana, Cuba, underway. It's been almost 90 years since the last American president in office, Calvin Coolidge, visited the island. And there is a lot on the agenda. Besides a meeting with Cuban President Raul Castro, there's some time with Cuban dissidents and a Major League Baseball exhibition game. The climax of today's events is the president laying a wreath at the memorial to the Cuban independence hero, José Martí. Ray Suarez knows well the significance of that gesture. He's the host of Al Jazeera America's Inside Story and author of Latino Americans, the 500-year legacy that shaped the nation. He says the diplomatic efforts underway today will unearth a long and deep history between the U.S. and Cuba, filled with warmth and regrets.
A lot of Americans don't know that the United States tried to buy Cuba, just buy it outright, several times in the 19th century. The earlier attempts were part of a broad view by American slaveholders in the South that Cuba was a natural next outpost for the United States and would increase the status of the United States as a slaveholding republic and allow agricultural interests to expand to tropical production like sugar and tobacco. And It didn't happen. There were overt and covert encouragements to Cuban revolutionaries to revolt against the crown of Spain in the hopes that American interests could eventually control Cuba. There is a long and tangled history between the two countries that went as far as the 20th century when, after the war with Spain, which liberated Cuba from the Spanish Empire, the United States passed an amendment in Washington that explicitly gave the United States interest and control over Cuban affairs. The country reserved for itself the right to reinvade Cuba if things didn't go in a way that Uncle Sam thought were headed in the right direction.
Would you say that the encouragement of revolutionary movements to throw off the Spanish crown sowed the seeds for the revolutionary movements that came back in the 1950s?
Sure, because to the revolutionaries who eventually triumphed and took Havana on New Year's Day 1959, their revolution was the successor to the Spanish Revolution. They thought they were throwing Uncle Sam out, among other things. So they thought of themselves as successors to José Martí and the leaders of the 19th century revolution. You know, José Martí is one of the few figures of the last, 100 plus years that Cubans on both sides of the Florida Strait agree on: his stature, his importance, his centrality as a symbol of the Cuban nation. And they both claim his legacy. But he's someone that I hope the president's wreath-laying will wake up Americans to, because he is a fascinating figure. Because he was involved in an anti-Spanish movement in the first unsuccessful Cuban War of Liberation, he was exiled and spent many of his years in exile here in the United States, 12 years in all. And when he first got here, he was in love with the United States and wrote moving, beautiful essays about the nature of democratic man. He covered the trial of the assassin of James Garfield and the national debate over whether or not that person should be executed. He was at the center of Caribbean exile politics from New York, where in league with other Cuban exiles and with Puerto Ricans and Dominicans, made common cause to kick the remnants of the Spanish Empire out of the Caribbean. So he is a fascinating Pan-American figure, as well as a great Cuban hero.
Since I know you're such a passionate lover of history, you'll take this question in the spirit in which it is directed at you. Would you say Martí is a George Washington, is a Benjamin Franklin, or a Alexander Hamilton, since Hamilton is so popular these days as a kind of revisionist figure in pan-American history?
Well, you know, he combines elements of all of them. But he's also a tragic figure, because as they lit the match to begin the Second War of Independence in Cuba, he, after tirelessly spending years on the move, raising funds to fight this Second War, goes back to Cuba and is killed years before the American invasion. So he does not live to see the independence of Cuba. He does not live to see the liberation of Cuba. So I think the outcome of the Spanish-American War, where Cuba is freed from Spain but then falls under the hegemony of the United States, is an outcome that would have broken Martí's spirit and broken his heart.
What would you make of the Obama visit in total here? Is it a Obama legacy visit, more for him than for the region and for history? Or is it a Nixon goes to China kind of thing?
You know, it's both. This will certainly be part of any history that's written of the Obama years, but it's also doing a lot of practical work toward reopening a relationship with geographically one of the country's closest neighbors that has been estranged for more than half a century. There are things that are highly symbolic, like the wreath laying at the Martí Monument, which will have tremendous import for Cubans in the United States and Cubans on the island. But they're also opening more agricultural trade possibilities, negotiating on banking regulations. President Obama is already lifting some of the restrictions that have made doing business, not only for Americans, but for everybody with Cuba, a lot easier, a lot more straightforward, a lot less constrained by some of the Cold War era actions of the last 20 years, certainly.
Glossing over the Cold War and all the business talk that's been everywhere, really, in the last nearly a year now, how emotional is all this as Obama does these things that no one would have imagined 5 years ago?
Well, I think the real effect of these things will be seen long after he leaves the White House, if someday the Cuban people can have a representative government that they choose, that does not constrain their freedoms, that does not constrain their human rights. That will be for another president to see. But boy, what a necessary set of first steps this is, if those days are ever to come. The Obama administration believes, as other presidents believed in our relationships with other countries like Vietnam and China, that you need to talk in order to undo the hostility and the estrangement of recent decades. Many of the president's critics, certainly in the Congress, certainly among organized Cuban exile groups, say the opposite. The president has made his choice. I guess history will give us the verdict as to whether these openings work.
He's host of Al Jazeera America's Inside Story, Ray Suarez, who's the author of the 2013 book Latino Americans. Ray, thanks so much.
A pleasure, John.
With all of the outrage and charges of illegitimacy being leveled at the Republican frontrunner Donald Trump, maybe his appeal has nothing to do with policy, with consistency, or his new programs. Clearly, he seems to be immune to all the negativity and mudslinging. It's as though his fame and celebrity evoke a reality show version of
Camelot. Camelot.
Excuse me.
I know it sounds a bit bizarre.
Lies, viciousness.
But in Camelot.
Oh, you'll be in trouble.
Camelot.
Get him out of here.
That's how conditions are.
Disgusting reporters, horrible people. I don't think I've ever had so many horrible, horrible things said about me in one week.
That's right, Camelot. It may sound a bit bizarre that Trump could represent a 21st century Camelot, complete with Florida palaces and New York City towers. But as he keeps winning, he keeps sounding like a cool, calm, collected king.
We are going to start winning again, and we're going to win so much, you are going to be so happy. We are going to make America so great again, maybe greater than ever before.
You know, the accusation of just making vague promises of making America great again were also a charge made against John F. Kennedy running back in 1960. And back then, the details about JFK's lackluster Senate career and lack of experience and just being the son of a rich guy mattered not at all in the 1960 campaign, much to Lyndon Johnson's frustration. Glamour trumps, experience. Virginia Postrel is author of The Power of Glamour, Longing and the Art of Visual Persuasion. She joins me now from Los Angeles. Virginia, welcome.
Hi, good to be with you.
So am I stretching it a little bit by making Trump a kind of a 21st century Camelot figure?
I think that's an interesting analogy, and I don't think you have to go all the way back to 1960, actually. Political glamour is relatively rare because usually our politicians are very well known, you know, Hillary Clinton being more typical. But in 2008, we had a campaign that was based on political glamour and hope and change and people projecting their, you know, their greatest desires onto a candidate. Trump is very different from Barack Obama in 2008, but it's a similar type of phenomenon where people see in the candidate a vision of America that they identify with, and they're projecting onto him their hopes and dreams in a way that is not about policy per se. So he talks about, I'm a builder, and the wall, his famous, you know, border wall, it's not just about literally getting a wall built. It's about being a doer, being somebody who can achieve things, and a vision of America as this kind of nation of doing.
Right. You know, we can go to the moon, you know, sort of idea.
Right, exactly.
In the 21st century. It's fascinating to think about. Now, in Trump's case, you know, the quality of aspiration that comes with Trump seems to be broader than Barack Obama in that, you know, everybody doesn't want to be or could be the first black president. Obama's glamour kind of goes with him, begins and ends with him. Clinton, to a certain extent, I don't think anyone would want to be a Clinton, but they might want to move in that circle. Trump really is somebody you could identify, or at least a whole class of Americans could identify actually being.
Throughout his career, he has had this interesting, long before he's in politics, he has had this interesting role in American culture as this kind of rich guy who represents an image of the rich guy that's very different from, you know, Mark Zuckerberg or Bill Gates or, you know, these kinds of tycoons. It's a throwback. It's a kind of blue collar image of what it would be like to be rich. And he's also, it's very important to think about the industries in which he built his wealth, which were, you know, real estate, travel. These are industries that traffic and glamour, that show you images that say, you know, come away on vacation to this hotel and you'll see, you know, you'll feel a new life or live in this penthouse. And wow, you know, it represents the life you wish you had.
You know, Reagan was able to fuse his Hollywood glamour with his self-made man narrative coming from a poor town in Illinois. And there was really no way to beat Reagan once that got going. How do you defeat someone with a very compelling story of glamour and success? You don't beat it by, you know, throwing darts at his resume, I think.
Right. Well, it's difficult. One thing that interested me when I started looking at Trump through the lens of glamour was seeing that it's largely a self-funded campaign, but he does have contributors just like any other candidate. And his contributors are largely these sort of Main Street business people. And I think if I were advising, you know, how do you strip off the glamour from Trump, it's to show him not as a doer and a builder and the kind of person that a Main Street business owner would like to be, but rather as the kind of, you know, sleazy guy who doesn't pay his bills, the kind of guy who screws Main Street businesses and so isn't the kind of guy that they would like to be. That would be one way to go at it.
And apparently there's some fact basis. There's some stories there to be told, yet to be told, that's for sure. Virginia Postrel is author of The Power of Glamour, Longing and the Art of Visual Persuasion. Virginia, thanks so much.
Thank you.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. The Republican Senate is apparently dug in on the new Supreme Court nominee. Could anything undig them? Chief Justice John Roberts last month spoke out with some disgust and impatience about the court's confirmation process, calling upon the Senate to make sure nominees are qualified and to leave politics out of the process. 2 weeks later, Justice Antonin Scalia died, and now President Obama has nominated Judge Merrick Garland to the Supreme Court, who is a respected friend of Chief Justice Roberts. Adam Liptak is the Supreme Court correspondent for our partner, The New York Times, who says, given the unprecedented refusal by Senate Republicans to consider Justice Garland before the election, there may be a moment for Justice Roberts to express his own feelings about the U.S. Senate. It would be, Liptak says, big news.
I don't know if he will speak out, but if he were to, people would certainly listen. It's not an abstract issue for him. He worked with and holds Judge Garland in high regard. They were on the Federal Appeals Court in Washington together. And at John Roberts' own confirmation hearing, he was presented with a case in which Garland had dissented from a Roberts majority opinion. And Roberts, you know, unprompted, said, whenever Judge Garland disagrees with you, you know you're in trouble.
How much do you think that relationship is going to be driving this, in a sense that Roberts may want Garland on this court, not for friendly reasons, but just to eliminate this kind of stridency and division?
Well, if we take Roberts at his word, and he spoke about this just last month, he thinks judges are judges. They're not Republicans. They're not Democrats. They're either qualified or not. And I would think if he means what he says, and those are the right criteria, he would welcome Judge Garland on the Supreme Court.
You know, oddly, that goes exactly what Democratic Senator Al Franken said on the show last week, that he's had it with all of this politics, and that his only criteria is if people would look at the nominee and then go, I want nine of those on the court. That really is a throwback to a time that I can barely imagine anymore. But it seems like Roberts is almost in agreement with Al Franken in that.
Right. Now, you might expect Al Franken to say that. Even if he believes it earnestly, you're not surprised to hear a Democratic senator say that. If you were to hear a Republican-appointed Chief Justice of the United States say it, even if it were exactly the same words, it would have a different kind of impact.
Oh, no question. Roberts is, you know, 10 aces in the deck compared to
a minority party member of the Judiciary Committee, but it is an interesting principle. Does Roberts have any specific clout other than his gravitas?
No, that's all it is. And I don't really understand politics. I don't know how the Senate works. I would think it would be an enormous moment and they would ignore him too. It does seem like the Republican senators are quite dug in on this. Roberts, when he spoke last month, just 10 days before Justice Scalia died, really worried that the American public is going to get the wrong impression about what the court does by it being spoken of at confirmation hearings and in the confirmation process as a political institution. He very much wants to think that it's above politics, that it's a disinterested judicial legal institution, not a political one. And he thinks these kinds of dragged on divisive political confirmation processes do damage to the reputation of the court.
Any hints of what other of the conservative justices might think, particularly Alito?
The only additional hint, and not a particularly conservative justice, is that Justice Kennedy, another Republican appointee, has taken on law clerks from Judge Garland's chambers, as have all of the liberals. He is one of perhaps the leading feeder judge. If Judge Garland vouches for a law clerk, that law clerk is very likely to get a Supreme Court clerkship, and that there's no other judge in America you can say that about.
That's a tantalizing hint. Adam Liptak is Supreme Court correspondent for The New York Times. Thanks so much, Adam.
Great to be here, as always.
And now we return to a story we told you about earlier this hour, the story of Nima Vese, a man whose brain suddenly began recording every experience he was having in vivid detail, archiving his life in a vast searchable database of feelings, images, everything. The condition is called hyperthymesia, first formally identified in 2006, and researchers at the University of California, Irvine, have confirmed just a few dozen cases in the world of minds like this with a record button stuck in the on position. Part of the exceedingly rare trait is now attributed to a higher correlation between the amount of white matter connecting gray matter in the brain. But for Nima Vese, just having a name to explain his vast memory has been a relief.
Almost an entire year of my life is experienced on a daily basis of just memories that come in an involuntary way. One half of it is understanding how the memories are organized within ourselves, which has not only taught me a lot about myself, but has taught me a lot about people around me as well. And the other half of it is that general practices that people consider for self-improvement have been takeaways that I've accumulated over the last 15 years in order to help me through this process.
Now, as you're speaking, you're making pauses, but it sounds like the pauses come from the fact that you're seeing actual pictures of what happened that day. It's racing by in your mind at the moment that you're speaking to me.
Exactly. And that's that's one of the big jokes about when I'm trying to tell a joke, for instance. I often start laughing before I ever tell the joke. And the reason is because in order to remember it and recall it, I go back to the moment in which I first heard it. So at the same time as I'm listening to it, it's as if the first time. So I'm feeling the same joy and giggles as if hearing it for the first time. And I mean, that's really one of the benefits as well, as time completely flattened for you with memories not fading. There are, of course, challenges in the sense that, let's say, for example, you go through a breakup or, you know, someone close to you passes away. The vast majority of people have a great luxury of the half-life of memories slowly fades into the background over weeks, months, and years. Whereas without that, since forgetting is not really a luxury that I have, I have to genuinely learn to forgive, since forgiving and forgetting isn't something that isn't really the easiest thing for me.
I'm thinking of some of the practical or impracticalities of this. I mean, in my particular case, I was paralyzed in an accident, a spinal cord injury, you know, 39 years ago. And I forgot the experience of walking almost immediately and realized that that was a mechanism inside my own brain to allow me to move forward, because I wasn't stuck in any of those memories. You don't have that ability.
No, I do not, John. It's forgetting is actually, there's new research coming out that forgetting is actually maybe a positive mechanism, maybe developed over time, that helps humans to adapt.
What hurt in your past won't fade because of this condition?
Everything. And, of course, everyone experiences hurt. Like when one is cut, they naturally bleed. But any loud noises, any sort of situations that may have been uncomfortable in my life have never faded. There was one instance where I was coming home late one night with one of my very best friends, and I was please forgive me. We were held at gunpoint in an attempted robbery. They didn't succeed in getting away with anything, and luckily we were unharmed. But there was a moment where I basically stepped between her and the gun, and things like that. For example,
you're experiencing that now.
Yes,
as though it's happening right now.
Yes, but I always relive that, and in a way, and the most important thing, just like anything else, from breakups to, you know, to people passing in your life, to someone, robbing you, or trying to, everything must be understood for what it is, and despite the fact that I don't have the luxury of forgetting the nuances of potentially negative things, I don't think there's an experience I've had in my life that I wasn't able to eventually acquire wisdom from. And it's that wisdom that I try to attach to every moment.
Do you think participating in the University of California Irvine study will help provide insights about how the brain does memory normally or in any way?
I absolutely do. I've been a part of the study for 7 years now, and one of the biggest stepping stones for me was having a name for it. And I went to many doctors, and the issue was that if the condition is not in, for example, the DSM-5, which is the standard catalog of conditions, then doctors would be disinclined to explore any further. So when I originally started that study, the biggest relief to me, in a way, was being able to put a name on something, and then from there you can manage it, and you can then have power over it and use it for better.
Do you think you would miss this if it went away tomorrow?
You know, I've been asked this recently, John, and in all honesty, if you would have asked me this question 15 years ago and just started me 10 years ago, I probably would have said no. Certainly would not have been sure, because I wasn't exactly in a place of understanding what I was dealing with. But I've reached a place where I appreciate what I have been given, either by chance or by my any number of factors. And I've now transformed that into a force of personal spiritual growth.
Well, Nima, thank you very much for speaking with us.
No, I appreciate it, John, and thank you for having me.
Nima Vese is an academic researcher at the George Washington University. He's also a professional painter who goes by the name Enigma of New York. You can see more of his work. Just go to thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.